This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.
When I was a kid growing up in Jersey, anybody who was a hoot or really funny or something, we'd call them a riot. Ladies and gents, this guy's a riot in more ways than one. Bob Dylan.
William Zantzinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore Hotel Society gathering, and the cops were called in and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked William Zantzinger for first-degree murder. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. This is Pod Dylan, a show that celebrates the work of Bob Dylan one song at a time, part of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, the freewheeling Rob Kelly. And joining us this week to talk about the lonesome death of Hattie Carroll from 1964 is The Times They Are Changing, is returning guest Roberta Rakoff. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, Rob, and I'm so excited that this song is going to be on your podcast before you leave, because I was really startled when you said no one had done it.
Yeah, a couple people have mentioned it on a list here and there, and then just for different reasons, we never got around to it. But yeah, this is when you pitched it to me, I thought, well, I wanted to have you on anyway. Once I decided when we were going to wrap up, I had always meant to reach out to you and have you back on. And then it sort of lined up perfectly that this is something that we should get to. It's a big song in his catalog, and it's an important song for multiple reasons, which we'll get into. So, okay, well, why did you want to talk about this one?
Well, you know, I have always loved this song, and it's always been in my head. I recently was working on an essay on Dylan and the pandemic, oddly. But of course, George Floyd happened during that period. And I was thinking a lot and researching Dylan's songs on race. And he has done such phenomenal work around racial issues in his music and, you know, for the United States. And he talks about how much of it, we've heard him talk about how much of what he does is rooted in the Civil War. But I think by that, he really means talking about what has happened to race in this country. So when you reached out to me, the song I thought about doing was his cover of Change Gonna Come at the Apollo Theater. And then you said, I've actually done that as a special show. It was just me. And I thought, how did I miss that? but I think we should talk about that a little bit with this song. Because that was such a powerful, your episode was terrific. And that was such a powerful representation of where Dylan is on this topic. And then I thought, well, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll is, it's a big song. It's an incredibly strong song, but it's also recognized by a lot of different people. And we can talk about that as maybe one of the greatest political songs to ever be written. And because of that, I thought it would be a shame if it didn't get done. There's so much to talk about with it. So there we are. That's the why.
All right. Well, reasonable enough. Yeah, that cover of A Change Is Gonna Come is one of, it might even be my single favorite song that Bob Dylan has ever covered. You know, one of his, you know, a song performance that's of a song that's not his. Part of it is, I just think the performance is so masterful, but also the weight of history that it comes with. And that, you know, that was a celebration at the Apollo. And it was in a show put on by African Americans for African Americans, singing songs from their culture, and you know, consequently, very, very few non African American artists are represented, but Bob Dylan is, and singing, not only is he there, he is singing one of the most revered songs, as you said, sort of like in the entire catalog of political songs, social justice songs. They're letting Bob Dylan sing it. And that, to me, underscored that this guy had the history of walking the walk, not just talking the talk, walking the walk. And he sort of deserved that to be on there singing that song. And he delivered it again. It was funny. But back when I tried to do that episode, I called around for guests for like months, and nobody offered up wanting to do it. I don't like doing shows by myself generally. I know that's not what the show is, but nobody would pipe up. And so I was like, all right, I really want to do this. So I just went ahead and did it on my own.
Well, you know, listening to the song, Rob, I actually think it was meant to be that you do that one on your own. And because you really nailed it. And when you said he was invited to sing a sacred song of the civil rights movement, right? And what an honor that was. And then when you watch it, if people haven't watched it, you know, it's on YouTube, you can find it. And you can just feel the love washing over him when he's done. And then he's standing there. And I said to one of your other guests, Aaron Callahan, I said, he looks like Abraham Lincoln or something standing there on the stage as an American icon himself in this iconic theater with this iconic song. And of course, the backstory about how Malcolm X challenged Sam Cooke with Blowing in the Wind and said, why is this white boy from Minnesota writing, you know, this and you haven't? And everything sort of leading up to that. And then Sam Cooke covering Blowing in the Wind. And then Dylan covering this song. It's such an amazing story. And then so representative. A lot of people don't know just how deep Dylan's canon of song Go Into Race. I mean, if there was another song, but I would never even try to tackle Willie McTell. It would make me so nervous I wouldn't be able to talk to you. But that's, you know, that's another song, and there's so many others where he's taking us through American history. And one of the most important issues in American history. So I'm glad that you did that, because you did a beautiful job on it. But I'm glad that this song was left for me. So
yeah, I mean, it's an enormously powerful song. I was back listening to it again, a bunch of different live versions. And, you know, it's very startling the way that he opens it, and that there's no, it starts with him singing, there's no instrumentation. And the line, I mean, the first line, as I said, William Zinzinger killed poor Hattie Carroll. First line. That's the song, you know, and it, you know, that whole record, the whole Times Era Change record by design is meant to be stark and in your face, kind of, you know, just throwing different issues at you and then, you know, kind of downshifting into more personal stuff. But it's not a particularly subtle record, and it's not meant to be. But I mean, this really just grabs you sort of by the collar and shakes you a little, and is like, hey, this is this thing we're talking about. And maybe, you know, and when this record comes out, some people knew of the case. A lot of people probably didn't.
Well, there is history to that. Because I too went back and looked up some of the history. You know, this song has been written about a lot. Greil Marcus writes about it in folk music, and Christopher Ricks wrote about it in Dylan's Versions of Sin. And my husband sent me this great podcast from the Poet Laureate of England about the song. So there's a lot of history behind it. But the Smithsonian, our National Museum, they have a journal on folklore. And several years ago, around 2015, they did a whole article on Hattie Carroll. There were 1,600 people at her funeral.
Wow.
And the story was picked up. I did not know any of this. The story was picked up by over 100 newspapers. So it was actually not a small incident. It was a big incident, and it got a tremendous amount of coverage. And, you know, Dylan said, we don't exactly know where he wrote the song, because some people say he wrote it on the trip home from the March on Washington. Some people say he wrote it in a New York cafe. If you remember in the Rolling Thunder review, when he and Joan Baez are having that conversation about, you know, you didn't tell me that you got married and whatever, but and she said, She said, I remember feeding you salad and red wine while you wrote, like ticker tape. She said, William Zantzinger, Hattie Carroll, the best song you ever wrote. And so, did he write it at Joan Baez's house? I mean, obviously, like all Bob's stories, there's a million of them. But the story itself was a very, very big story at the time, and quite widely covered. And it's a surprise if you think about it, because we didn't have film, we didn't have those kinds of things to cover the story, but it got picked up and was talked about quite a bit. I also think when you mention the times they are changing, and it was interesting for me to go back and listen to the whole record or the whole CD or whatever this is I'm holding here, and think about as you go through the list of songs, it's almost as if his songs are maturing on the CD until they get to Hattie Carroll. Because The Times They Are Changing is a great song. I mean, no question about it. And people really know that song. But I don't think it's on the level of The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. And then you get, With God on Our Side. And again, a song that has a lot. We know that song, but not one I think that has quite the staying power. And then Only a Pawn in Their Game, which is, But when Dylan writes Only a Pawn in Their Game, he's written mostly songs about individuals, right? He's written the death of Emmett Till, for example, and they're songs that talk about an individual, something individually that happened. And Only a Pawn in Their Game, of course, talks about the death of Medgar Evers without ever, but he also in that song, he kind of starts to go out of the individual story into, he talks about the fact that poor whites being duped into thinking that blacks are their enemy. And so he starts to kind of look at something systemically, but then he gets to Hattie Carroll. And I think Hattie Carroll is a huge leap forward in terms of really talking about the underpinnings of the unfairness of the justice system. Racism, the callousness of what could happen to black people, and he really knocks down the pillars of the establishment in this, and I think it's a big leap forward for him. That's a lot that I just said.
Well, it's a big song, and I do think you mentioned its placement is. I mean, look, obviously, all of his songs are placed in very particular spots. None of this is meant to suggest that it's haphazard. But this being the penultimate song on the record, I think is instructive in certain ways. And on top of everything you just said, it's also I always felt like especially the last three lines of essentially the chorus, he's castigating people who, might be sympathetic to the plight of anybody who is mistreated like this by rich white people versus and also mistreated by the justice system, but don't really want to do anything about it. I mean that to me that but you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Yes, these people are shedding a tear over this story that they're reading, but they're probably not going to do anything about it. And I think he's trying to, again, grab those people by the lapel and say, "Well, go do something. Don't just be upset about it. Don't just write a sad tweet. Go out and do something about it."
And I think you're exactly right. I think he both identifies the unfairness of the justice system, and we can talk about that. He really gives you a picture in a very almost restrained way of racism. And then he does this chorus over and over again that's basically saying, what are you going to do about it? And then he changes it in the very last chorus, right? Because everything before the last chorus is, now ain't the time for your tears. And then we get to the end of the song, and he says, for now is the time for your tears. And I think there he's saying, now you have to act now. And that's a call, that's a call to action, but not in a polemical way. It's a call to action in a much more subtle way. And I think that's a lot of the to me, part of the brilliance of this song is in some ways it strengthens it in its restraint, right? There are a lot of songs that this is not a, it's only superficially a topical song. It really is far beyond that because it lasts. And if you think about how you would apply it now, this is still where we are in so many ways, right? I mean, this song could have been written about George Floyd and the justice system, right? It could have been written about the way the justice system treats black men in this country. I mean, there's so many, so it's topical in some ways, but 90% of it really, I think this is a song that will last and last and last. And it's interesting, and I wonder what your thoughts are about this, Rob, because I don't think it's as a very, there are people who really write about Dylan who just fixate on this song, but I don't think most people know this song. You know, I mean, or not, they don't know it like they would know Blowing in the Wind, or they don't know it like they would know The Times They Are Changing, or you know, other songs that we would deem as political.
Oh, it's certain. This was a song I didn't know about until I got this record, and I was, getting into Bob for the first time, and I was not familiar with it. So yeah, I learned about it. I learned about all of this through the song. So yeah, it's certainly not one of his most famous. I mean, it probably gotten more famous now, but at least at the time, yeah. I mean, I didn't know who Hattie Kerrouac. I didn't know anything about it.
And I think the structure of the song is very, it's very, and the wording and the way it lays out, it's almost like by being restrained in some ways, he makes the song more powerful. So, you know, so many what we would call topical songs or protest songs or whatever are so much more in your face. But he makes the point here. Partly by repeating things over and over again, by drawing a picture, you can see that cane flying through the air that kills her, right? That causes her to have a brain hemorrhage. So the real story, when you read the story about William Zantzinger, who went to his grave apparently just hating Bob Dylan.
He did. I love that quote. That well, I love the idea that there was this guy out there who's just angry. Here's the quote. He says, first of all, he dismissed the song, saying it actually had no effect upon my life, which is, sure. When Bob Dylan writes a song about you, it doesn't have an effect on your life. But he said of Dylan, he's a no account son of a bitch. He's just the scum of a scumbag of the earth. I should have sued him and put him in jail.
I know. It's one of the. It's just such a great quote. They should have put it on the back of. You know, too bad they couldn't put it on the back of the CD, because it. You know, it. He. He it really, really got to him. But the story, even before he threw the cane at Hattie Carroll, because this was all in the Smithsonian magazine, he was hitting another waitress with a cane. He was beating her with his cane. And he was calling people, he and his wife, you know, turn up at this fancy, it was a, I'm trying, the Spinster's Ball in Baltimore, right? Because and if you weren't married by 25, you were called a spinster and whatever. And they're raising money for some good cause for disability people with disabilities. But they get there, and he and his wife are absolutely bomb drunk when they get there, and he just begins to abuse everybody. And the idea that you're at this fancy—I was trying to picture this—that you're at this fancy ball, and one of the people who is a guest takes up a cane and starts beating one of the waitresses it seems unfathomable, doesn't it? So he was really a jerk. He was really dreadful. I mean, so the real story is worse. But, you know, the story that is in the song is, of course, bad enough. And I don't know if you got to watch the clip where Bob played it on the Steve Allen show.
Oh, it's an amazing clip. It's just if yeah, it's on YouTube, everybody. It is not only is it's a great performance of the song, but the preamble where he's talking to Steve Allen is just unreal to see him almost monosyllabic. And I don't know whether that's a put on or he really was that nervous, but it's, you're just like, really, this kid is a genius. And then he breaks into the song and you go, oh, holy shit. You know?
Right. Right. And there's that sort of great point where Steve Allen says to him, you know, do you want to tell us the story? Do you want to sing it? He goes, well, it would take me as long to tell the story.
Right.
You know, as to, I mean, it would take me, when I'm done singing it, there is no story left to tell because the story is in the song. And he asks him, you know, what prompted him to write it. And he talks about the new story. But then he says, and I thought this was a really interesting moment, Rob. He says, the new story gave me the opportunity to say something I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
So that he had something, he's almost saying, you know, we know that he had been down in Mississippi. He had done other things. His, you know, girlfriend was very involved in the civil rights movement. He has connections there. So obviously he's thinking about this and has had a lot on his mind. But he said, I took the story and I changed the words. Right. And Steve Allen's like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Poor Steve Allen. Yeah. He's kind of the, what is this kid talking about?
Yeah, he's trying to keep up, right?
Yeah.
And Steve Allen is a great interviewer. I mean, he's just mm-hmm. wonderful, and he had amazing people on this program. But Dylan said, this gave me what I needed to say something I already wanted to say, which is really interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So almost like this was my spark.
Yeah.
And yeah, I could turn it into this.
It won't surprise anybody to learn that William Zenger, after this, continued to be a terrible person. You know,
oh, yeah.
I mean, he became a slumlord and was put in jail again for, you know, like faking his taxes related to being a slumlord and abused his tenants. And I mean, one of these people who's just been, you know, kind of just went through life being awful. I mean, unfortunately, we elect those people president now, but
right
I mean,
now,
back then,
yeah.
You know, this is like the Roger Stone of, you know, 1964 kind of thing. But I mean, it's just one of those things. You're like, yeah, this guy. I mean, look, if you're William Zantzinger, I get why you look at this song as like, first of all, it's kind of amazing on a legal front that Bob could even put this song on a record. I can't imagine an artist today being able to do this. I think they would just regard it as such a libel or whatever, you know, you want to, but I mean, it's kind of amazing that even a major record company, Columbia Records, would sort of sign off on this and go,
right,
yeah,
and
all right.
Good, you know, good for Columbia that they did
that,
right? I mean, good for them that they made that space and they did it. But you know, as I was thinking about it, just kind of going through some of the individual verses, and I had underlined some bits of it. One thing I underlined was, he says, in a matter of minutes, on bail, was out walking. And when I say that the song is going to last, so I live just outside Chicago. I live 6 blocks from Chicago, in Evanston, Illinois. And we just went through, in the last couple of years in Illinois, we eliminated cash bail. And the reason we eliminated cash bail was that there's an organization here called the People's Lobby, and they had gone out to meet with lots of people in the community, in the Black community, in churches and whatever, and said, what do you, you know, what's the next issue you want us to work on? And they were expecting, you know, housing or the schools or whatever. And the issue that came back over and over again was cash bail. Mm. And the reason it came back was that a tremendous percentage of Black people in Illinois who were locked up in prison were there because they couldn't make cash bail. They couldn't make their bail. So they sit in prison for all of this time. And after 10 years of working on this, Illinois has eliminated cash bail.
Hmm.
But then you've got this line here. He says, here's a white guy. He can make bail. He's a rich, you know, he has this sort of double thing. He's He has rich, wealthy parents, right? So he's doubling down on the wealthy side of it, and he has people, you know, he has relations who are in office, or he's connected, and so he gets to walk out. He gets, you know, he has committed what eventually goes down to manslaughter, but he has committed a murder. And he gets to walk out of jail immediately. And in fact, they make it possible for him to make sure he can bring his tobacco crop in.
Yeah.
So, you know, right there you begin to see he leads with that, and then he gets us, you know, as we go further down, and he's talking about the justice system. He uses language to indict it without yelling about it. So, you know, you get to the verse that starts in the courtroom of honor, right? He starts with that line. And then, you know, we're always looking at the judges, Your Honor. So the courtroom is supposed to be a place of honor. And that, you know, the judge, by he's pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded, and even the nobles get properly handled. You know, so he's repeating, or he's laying out what the myth is about the justice system here. And then, you know, then he, as the song goes on, he obviously, you know, continues to indict that he gets, he walks out. So you're thinking, you know, he walks out with a 6-month sentence for killing somebody.
The line in that verse about the ladder of law has no top and no bottom, I feel like
Right.
that's one of his all-timers. That
Yeah,
that
that it's
single
a
line.
it's an absolutely great line. And he also, I think he does a wonderful job of, with very few lines, painting the picture of Hattie Carroll and William Zantzinger, right? So we get, you know, that incredible verse where he describes Hattie Carroll. He doesn't call her a kitchen maid. He calls her a maid of the kitchen, which is interesting, right? It's almost a more respectful term, I think. And then he gives us a picture of her life, that she was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children. And she came from, you know, a big, close family of people who had working class jobs, you know, in Maryland, but her husband was a veteran, and tons of, you know, lots of relatives, all of whom kind of worked in working class jobs. But when he says she gave birth to 10 children, the saying that she gave birth to 10 children is giving you a message that not all of them survived, which turns out to be true. That two of her children had not survived. So he, you know, he's carefully painting a picture here. And then we get these lines, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about it, where he keeps repeating about the table, right? That she never sat once at the head of the table and didn't even talk to the people at the table, and who just cleaned up the food at the table and empty the ashtrays on a whole other level. And you know, what do you think of that repeating over and over again? And how that makes a song more impactful. There's something about that repetition.
Yeah, I remembered hearing the song for the first time, and you know, that jumped out at me of like, that's interesting. He's using the same word for three lines in a row, and I knew enough about Bob Dylan at that point. I was enough of a fan to be like, okay, that's not him being sloppy. This is on purpose. I don't exactly know what the purpose is, but I'm noticing it. And you know, over time, you know, Bob himself has commented on it, and he talks about the song in Chronicles, where he says that this song was inspired by Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill, and he said something to the effect of that, you know, Woody Guthrie has never written a song like this, and he says it has free verse association, the structure and disregard for the known certainty of melodic pattern to make it seriously matter, giving its cutting edge And again, a lot of the stuff when Bob talks about this stuff, I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. You know, the known certainty of melodic pattern. I'm like, all right, Bob, I have no clue what you're talking about.
As long as he knows what he's doing.
As long as he knows. Yeah, he knows what it means something to him. But the table,
yeah.
It kind of, to borrow a phrase that I've used many other times from another fandom of mine, the MASH, Larry Gelbart, the great Larry Gelbart, who created that show, refers to, there's an episode of MASH called The Interview, which is done in black and white. And it's the cast is being interviewed by an unseen reporter for a newsreel. And so it is nowadays we're used to that, you know, people talking to the camera, The Office and Modern Family and a million other shows do it. But 1975, that was pretty startling. And anyway, Larry Gelbart refers to that episode as artful in its artlessness, in that it was so simple and so stripped down that it becomes kind of weirdly avant-garde because it is so basic. And I feel like that's what at least that section is that I'm not even bothering to come up with a rhyme that will make this part of the song go down easier. You know, I mean, you can have the most hard to deal with concepts, but if they are put in a very attractive rhyme scheme, it's like the spoonful of sugar. You know, it's that, but this doesn't do that. It's table, table, table. It's reminding you of the weirdly artlessness of it, of like, we're going to just talk about this woman's whole life was probably devoted to a table. She was the maid of the kitchen, right, as you're saying. Right. Her whole life revolved around taking care of the table for these rich people. And that is the focus of her life. And it's when, and because of her connection is what ends up killing her. And so it is Bob's way of sort of pulling you out of the song a little and reminding you like, okay, this is not meant to go down easy. This is, so I'm going to do the harsh of, you're going to hear this word three times in a row. And every time I listen to it, it jumps out because it's so unusual.
You know, and I'm going to read something, and it's the only thing I'm going to read. I promise. But I'm sure you've read Folk Music, the Greil Marcus book.
Yes.
And he writes about the lonesome death of Hattie Carroll. And I remember this leapt out at me when I read the book. And he talks about he's driving in Minnesota and he's listening to Bob Dylan and this, he's listening to this song, and he says, "That day in Minnesota, all I could hear was the perfection of the song as a work of art, of how perhaps the horror of the event brought out an apotheosis of craft that Dylan had never quite found before and would never find again. All I could hear was a few minutes of the sort of aesthetic measuring and balancing necessary to write two people who would have otherwise been forgotten into history and write a song that would itself become part of history and make its own history."
Hmm.
And, you know, I think what Greil Marcus is saying there is, you know, what you're saying about how the craft of what he does here is so, it seems simple, but it's not. And how difficult what he does in these few verses through his songwriting craft is to make the song take on this life of its own. It's one of those things. When you listen to, I think the first Dylan song I fell in love with was Mr. Tambourine Man. And I think for a lot of people, that's our first song that, you know, you just were so blown away by it. And it is this wonderful, complex mix of surrealistic language, right? And you're just all swept up in this. This is not that. This song is so stripped down. It's nothing like, you know, it's nothing like some of his other work where the language is, you know, the language just takes you down this river of words that it's great. And it's always great when he does that. But this is not that. The simplicity of this song hammers you on the head. And I don't know how he makes that work.
That's an unfortunate metaphor you just used, but
oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. Right. You,
But
there you go. You're right. Very unfortunate for this,
yeah,
but
I mean,
yeah.
but
Yeah.
yeah, totally. And by the way, one other thing. All right. There's something I want to ask you about the title, but before I forget this, like
Yeah.
one thing, it's I noticed this, and I've mentioned this in other episodes. I don't think there is a single figure in our society who appears more in Bob Dylan songs than judges.
Right.
I think there's more judges in his songs than doctors, than lawyers, than cops, than anything, even maybe even singers. It's judges. That is obviously an endless point of fascination for Bob Dylan, is the people who sit and render judgment, and are they, as he puts it here, on the level? It's so much about, on the level. And you were saying the lines are so basic and so direct, and there's very little allusion, very little metaphor, except for the books being pulled and persuaded, the nobles getting properly handled. I mean, that's a little more florid, but yeah, it is so straightforward. But I want to ask you about the title, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. Now, part of it is Bob is just good at writing captivating titles. There's a whole subset of stuff I've seen out there where people have created like paperback book covers based on Bob Dylan song titles, because his song titles are so evocative and they have that feel to them. But the title, though, is The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. Now, on the one hand, if you want to get dark, you could say, well, we all die alone on some level because we're dying alone. Even if we're surrounded by friends and family, we are alone because we're the only one going through this process. But most people, when you hear the phrase the lonesome death, it suggests dying alone, like being, in a room by yourself or laying in a ditch somewhere, like some horrible lonely. And that is not what happens. She died in a room full of people. She didn't die in the room. She was struck, and it caused all this injury, but she was surrounded by people. She did not die a lonesome death, at least the way you sort of figure it in the title. What do you think he's getting at that by putting it in those terms?
That's such a great question, Rob. And I wonder if what he's getting at is how the callousness of someone thinking they could do that and the fact that they get away with it and the fact that their punishment is so light is she's diminished. It doesn't diminish her life because, there's this song and 1600 people turned out at her funeral and all of those things. But it's saying that in that room at that time, that her life in the eyes of society was so not worth anything. That here was this woman who had raised 10 children, had worked hard, had lived a really exemplary life, was loved in her church and all of those things. But in that room at that hotel at that time, none of that counted. She wasn't an individual. She wasn't that person in the eyes of the man who killed her. And maybe that's what he means.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, it is possible to, again, to be alone in a room full of people. You're not literally alone, but you are emotionally or spiritually alone. I mean, I've read descriptions of the event, and you just say, God, why didn't anyone step in and stop this guy? Now,
Well,
he was
exactly.
drunk, but I mean, clearly it's like he hit her enough time. You think after the first one, somebody was, but no, they're at this weird spinster's ball thing. And I just, when white rich white people are bored, watch out, everybody, because they
Right, I
just get into
guess.
weird shit,
So I think you're really onto something there, Rob. The room was filled with people, but not anybody who cared about her. And not anybody who cared about the other woman who was beaten by Zanzinger. So maybe, I think you're right that the word lonesome is a very important word. It's very important. And just as we're talking, I'm just thinking that maybe what he's saying there is it didn't matter how many people were in the room, she was alone. And there was no one to speak for her. There was no one to intervene for her. And there was no one to come between the black staff and this pretty abusive, violent guy who had been being abusive for a long time. but that it also, I think, goes back to those table lines again, that she's almost unseen. She doesn't have a seat at the table. She doesn't, she can't talk to the people at the table. And so it's almost that she is invisible to almost everybody in the room, and remains invisible while she's being attacked, which is astonishing, right? But I'm glad you, I hadn't thought about the word lonesome until you just said that. So
Yeah, I mean, it's not the death of Hattie Carroll, it's the lonesome death of
lonesome
Hattie. That's a
death.
very particular word to insert. Another thing, looking back over this is, when Bob, by the time Bob got to Blood on the Tracks, that was a big part of the legend of that record, is that it's the songs are bopping around in time. And he talked about the working with Norman Raven, the painter, who said, who taught, as Bob said himself, taught him to look at time in a different way. But this song is doing that, right? This song
Yeah.
opens post-murder, and
Right.
then it flashes back to the biographies of our characters, leads up to the murder, and then jumps forward back in time again to being post-murder. So this song is, I mean, like I mentioned at the beginning, it opens with Zinzinger killed poor Hattie Carroll. So the crime has already happened
Yeah.
by the time the first line of the song is being sung. And yet we're going to go back talking about the cane flying through the air and stuff like that. So it's a jumble of time, which again, I think gives you that sort of like discombobulated feel of like, well, wait a minute, what exactly happened here? And how did, and almost like that Zinzinger was exonerated so fast, that the levers of power can work. And this is something that I have been, that has been in my mind lately, because I listen to a lot of political podcasts and they're talking
Yeah.
about the dangers we are facing as a country in
Right.
terms of what could happen. I don't want to get into the details of it because I just don't want that name to even pass my
No.
lips on this podcast.
No,
But
we'll spit three times and yeah.
yeah, but it's there are there when you want to pull the levers of power in a destructive way, there are ways to do it so fast that the it's kind of like the whole the Mark Twain thing about the, a lie travels the planet in the time it takes truth to put its pants on, and it's like there are ways to pull levers of power in either this country or the world that are so destructive, that move so fast, that you, as the person or the organization that has to clean up after it, can't keep up. You cannot
Right.
keep up because the destruction is being wreaked so fast that you're, by the time you are reacting to it, they've already moved on to the third or fourth monstrosity that they want to do. And so that's kind of what this is that we're like, wow, before we've even really had a chance to know who Hattie Carroll is and the situ and the details of the situation, Zinzinger has already been acquitted. He's already
Right.
been given a light sentence, all because he's got a tobacco crop to deal with. Like, what in the hell are we talking about? I mean,
And
that's
they Yeah, they even imprisoned him in a different jail so he wouldn't be around a lot of black prisoners.
yeah, well,
Yeah, I
don't do
mean
that
they,
crime then, how
yeah,
about that?
right. Yeah, and so, if we follow Dylan's career and you think about so many of the later songs and how they then, if you think about how I'm not even going to try to talk about Blind Willie McTell, which I think for me is has to be in his top five masterpieces. But in Blind Willie McTell, I mean, he just encompasses everything from 60. It's a 1619 song. I mean, we go back to slaves arriving here. We go back, you go back to the plantations and, so he continues to write music that becomes increasingly more insightful, more complex about America's original sin, and he does an amazing job with it. And I always think that we forget that in addition to being a great songwriter, and in addition to being an incredible performer and just watching these different performances, those early performances, like the one at Carnegie Hall, they're incandescent. I mean, they're just They're amazing when it's just him and a guitar and this song. But he's a social historian. He, I mean, we know how much Dylan understands history, and we know how much he thinks about history, and you know, he how much he goes into it. And with this music, he has created a body of work that gives us a different way of getting a visceral understanding of what this has meant in our country. And I think it's magnificent. I realize this isn't our lightest, most cheerful show that we've
No.
done, but this is a major contribution from him, not just musically, but to our understanding of ourselves.
And you mentioned earlier that what Dylan said, that this song gave him the opportunity to say the thing he wanted to say. And I think that that's underscored by the fact that he has continued to perform the song, not a lot,
Not a
but
lot,
it's
but
been
over a long time.
But over a long time, yes, that's exactly what I was getting at. 296 times between 63 and 20. By the way, he started performing it before the album even came out, so people got a chance to hear it. But 296 times from 63 to 2012. And so, yeah, not a lot, but obviously, it's if you can look at it and say, well, the song is not really about Hattie Carroll Williams and Singer, it's about something greater, then you can apply that to any time frame that you choose to sing it in. And he sings it in the 70s, and of course there's a bunch of versions of it at the Rolling Thunder review. I don't want to get too bogged down in the criticizing of something 50 years old. There's something about hearing a chorus on a group of singers singing along with Bob on the chorus that doesn't quite work for me. There's something about it. Just this is not a group sing along song.
No, I was actually going to ask you what your thoughts were on the different versions, because I listened to those early versions. You know, when you see whether he's singing it live or the recorded version, whatever, are just, I think, the best ones in a lot of ways. And I'm a big Rolling Thunder fan. I mean, I love everything about that period. I don't care that he's screaming at us all the time, and you know, I really love it. But I don't love that version. I don't, in the same way that I love the earlier versions. It's almost too. It's you know he it it, it it's so loud, and it's so boom boom. You know, and these earlier versions are sort of pure. I would have loved to have been at that Carnegie Hall concert, right? Once and seen that, because that must have been really something. You know, I know you always say to people, what would you have liked to have seen recorded? But I always thought if there was a concert I could go to, I would have wanted it to be one of the Rolling Thunder review concerts. But I actually think that Carnegie Hall concert, you know, would have been amazing to be at.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, no, the Rolling Thunder, like I wish there was like the Rolling Thunder take he does of Tangled Up in Blue, the one where the video exists, where it's just him in his face, and it's just him. To me, if they had done a Hattie Carroll like that, I think I would have been like, oh my God, this is it. There's just something about hearing Bobby Neuwirth and the other guys singing along with it. I just go,
No, it doesn't work.
No, I
It
love
doesn't
Bob
work.
singing it. Bob is it's so intense. And it's again, it's just on the chorus. It's not, I don't mean to be too critical of it, but just there's something about this song that it needs to sound sort of spare, and it's just one person's kind of screaming into the void, not having a group of people do it. But I mean, at the same time, it's something that he returns to kind of on the regular too, like every, the 70s. And then there's a bunch of performances in the 80s, and then the 90s, and then the 2000s. Like he goes through it because, as we talk about, this has not changed. Unfortunately, this has not changed. We have made absolutely no development in this at all. There are a million Williams and Zingers nowadays. They all have blue checks. I mean, it's just, it's that kind of stuff, and it's unfortunate. But so it's a song that he can use to his own purposes, and it can be divorced from the original inspiration, which was this unfortunate true life event.
I think it's interesting. You know, as I was preparing for this, and I too went back and looked at, you know, there are all these versions that I haven't seen, and I came across one. It was in some outdoor venue in Hamburg in 1984. And he's wearing that funny little straw hat thing that, he was wearing for a while there. And it's so great. And I thought it was interesting because obviously, you and I both know he has songs that he has played hundreds and hundreds of times. So for many people, playing a song 296 times, 90, whatever it was, would be a lot. But for Bob, it's nothing.
It's relatively low, yeah.
But I think what you said is a really interesting point. He played it over such a long period of time, not constantly, but it would just keep coming back. So I think the song means something for him. Because it's not like you have an audience going, "Oh, please sing The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll," right?
Right, yeah.
They're not shouting that out,
Yeah. Yeah, the
But
7 minute song. Yeah, please, yeah,
yeah.
please do that. Yeah.
Yeah, but he wants to do it. So I think this is a song that I'm biased about. I think this one lives forever.
Yeah. Oh, agree. Totally agree. It's that's that term I've used where I feel like this is one of those songs that the average person that only knows who Bob Dylan is on a basic level through basic cultural osmosis. They know the hits, they know, oh yeah, that's the guy that does Lay Lady Lay and Like a Rolling Stone Blowing in the Wind. They don't know this song, but this is a song that his fans of a certain level know. And yeah, this is the other genius songs that undergird the other songs, not just the hits that these other deeper cuts, they're genius too, in just a completely different way.
So it's great. So I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to talk about this. I want to put in a pitch. People should go back into your catalog and find that unique little show that you did by yourself on Change Gonna Come, because that is an episode that is really worth listening to.
Well, thank
And it's a terrific episode. And so everybody who's listening, go back and find it. You can just, you'll find it in Rob's, back catalog
Yeah,
there.
it's in there. I forget what number it is, but it's like 144 or something like that. But yeah, it's in there. It said it that's that cover meant so much to me, and I was like, I'm dying to talk about this, And like I said, I think it's songs like this that got him on that stage. It's him singing, of course, with Martin Luther King, when he was there. I mean, it's this that kind of stuff. Again, the guy, one other point worth making as we are wrapping up here. It is, in the olden days, it was a lot harder for famous people to take on an issue that was unpopular because there wasn't. I just think there was a lot more to lose, and there were actors. Sometimes you go back and you find footage of somebody like I've seen. I grew up with like Charlton Heston being the NRA guy, and then you see footage of him at the six, in the 60s marching for equal rights for African Americans. You're like, man, okay, boy. And when he was younger, he really put his, he really did it, and Bob Dylan as a young man had a lot to lose. Yes, he came up from the folk scene and that was part of it, but he was ascendant and he wanted to be, he was ambitious, as we knew. And so there was probably a lot to lose for maybe taking on stances that people didn't want to hear. I mean, we talked about that Steve Allen performance. Try to imagine the audience that was watching the Steve Allen show in 1964. Did they want to hear about this? Did they want to hear Bob Dylan sing a 7 minute song about the murder of Hattie Carroll? Probably not. But he did it anyway because he was so committed to his muse, and that's what earned him the reputation that he so richly deserves.
So I'm really grateful that we got to have this talk, because you're so great to talk about this with, and it's a song that just means it has meant a lot to me, and I'm just so happy to have gotten to do that.
Well, again, I appreciate you coming back on. Again,
Well,
we've gotten to be great friends
we
through
have.
the show, and I really do appreciate
So
that. And we get to meet each other at the Tulsa thing, which was great.
we did. And so I'm going to barge in here and say something about the show. And I know
Oh
you're
boy.
having
I'm
people
editing all
there.
this
So,
out, by the way, so.
okay. But no, you don't edit this out. So I just want to tell you. So I didn't really listen to a lot of podcasts before the pandemic. I just didn't. I had a 3-hour round trip commute to my job on the west side of Chicago, and that,
Oof.
that sitting on the L was, you don't want to be sitting there not paying attention and missing your stop or whatever. So, but then there we were, and we were home, and the we're locked in our houses, and I began looking at podcasts because you're losing your mind, right? And I came upon yours, and I'm sure other people would say what I'm going to say, so don't edit this out. It made us part of a community when you couldn't be with other people, and it meant a lot. I mean, I've loved it since we could go out and do things, and I always enjoy them, but that period of time when we were stuck at home, this show connected you not just with you, but with all of these other people. And it really is, it's hard. It really meant a great deal. So thank you for that. I don't care if I'm embarrassing you. You just have to put up with it.
Well, yeah, I do appreciate you saying that. And that was absolutely part of the equation when I started it. That's why we formed the network when we did, and why I started the show the way I did, because I wanted to go out and talk to other Dylan fans, because that's fun, and I got a chance to. And so, yeah, thank you. That was definitely one of the goals of the show, and so I very much appreciate you saying that it did that exact thing for you. So thank you, Roberta. Okay, we're done. We're done with
We're done.
the
Okay,
done
we're
talking
done.
about
I
that.
won't say anything else. I'm not
All
going to get
right. Why
all
don't you
weepy.
tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Well, I'm afraid I'm still on Twitter, under Roberta Rico, because you connect with people on there. And I'm on Instagram, just my name. And I'm on Threads. I mean, I don't know why, because I don't post. There's too many networks now that where you're trying to connect with people. But I think that these have been important for our Dylan community, if nothing else. So they're still there.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, you can find this show on Twitter and Blue Sky under Pod Dylan. And if you want to access the first 100 episodes of the show, you can subscribe to Pod Dylan over on fmpods.com. The show will, as I mentioned before, it will remain on the network, and all the shows past 100 will remain where they are in place. So you can go back and listen to them all if you aren't so inclined. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you later. Bye.
A song that's on there, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll.
The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. What's the story of this song?
The story I took out of the newspaper, and I only changed the words.
Changed the words?
Yeah, I changed the words.
I don't understand. You took a story out of a newspaper.
It's a true story.
Oh, I see.
And it happened in Maryland.
Uh-huh. What words did you change? I still don't know what you mean by that.
Well, I changed the reporter's view into I used it. I used it for something that I wanted to say, and I used his view, the many reporters' view, to get at what I wanted to say and turn it that way. And I used a true story, that's all. I could have used a made-up story.
The story, I mean, the actual incident, did it concern someone named Hattie Carroll?
Yeah.
I see. Do you want to tell us about that incident, or would you rather do that by means of a song?
Well, I could tell you about it. I could sing about it. I could do anything. If I talked about it, I would talk about it for a very long time. If I sung about it, it would only take as long as a song.